Our speaker today served 6 years on the Senate Finance Committee, and it's a very powerful committee for the legislature. He was co-chair for a historical 6 years. You don't have to look far in Ketchikan to actually see the benefit that we here locally have received from him being co-chair on Senate Finance. This past session, he was, and he will continue to be, the chair of the Senate Health and Social Services Committee, and I personally have appreciated his very effective approach to chairing that committee. He's a fourth-generation Alaskan. He has a wife, Lorene, a daughter, Susie, and a dog, Coho. He founded Pioneer Capital Management in 1986, and the business is still very active today, so he knows what it takes to be a successful business leader. I've had the unique privilege of working for him for over 6 years, and his practical, sound advice never ceases to amaze me. Just this morning, we were having a very serious conversation, and he was explaining to me the financial benefit of investing in doggy chew toys. So would you please help me give Senator Stedman a warm welcome.
That is actually true, that last statement. Well, it's very nice to be here today, and it's really nice to come in here on an occasion like this and get to talk about economics and capitalism and community and family and so on and so forth, because it's basically heading into a presentation that's going to come here in a few minutes when I'm done on entrepreneurship and customer service, and there are, of course, rollouts of the capitalist market and capitalism. But if I could back up just for a minute. Years ago, in another life, I went to school down in Oregon and came back with an education from the University of Oregon, financed by a good part by the state of Alaska, and that's one reason why I thought it'd be nice to come back. Anyway, as we rolled forward in years, I joined the chamber, gosh, I don't know, 86 maybe, 85, I think somewhere in there. And then I was a Rotarian for several years, and as mentioned, Paul Harris Fellow. And as we all know, Rotary is a way for the business community to give back to the community. And I think, as I recall, it started out of Chicago. Is that right? So anyway, as we fast forward now today, almost 30 years later, it's real nice to be able to stand here and, one of the awards that are going to come up is going to be on customer satisfaction and the entrepreneurial spirit. But if you take a look around just our community here, and you can see the spirit and how it lives, much broader than just the lucky folks today that are going to get the award. When you look at the community the last decade and a half coming out of the downturn in the timber industry. And there's been some remarkable resilience, even though we're not in any way, in a lot of measurements, back to where we were 20 years ago, either here or on the western side of Southeast where the other pole went down. But nevertheless, the people have rebounded and we have moved forward and rebuilt our shoreside infrastructure. We've done a lot of work on the roads, and mentioned by one of the participants today in the lunch, there's still some more road work to be done here in the community, and frankly several other communities. But we've also taken the opportunity to try to enhance our communities and our family structures through construction of libraries, through construction of fire halls, and those type of issues, gun ranges, boat ramps, some of this, the basic stuff that helps hold families together and have them recreate. Because as we concentrate on our business and our daily lives of taking care of our family and our friends and our community, without a good recreational ability, we end up with residual issues in the community, substance abuse problems that we're all struggling with, my family, extended family included. And those type of things. And so today, you know, to stand here, I asked Julie, you know, to write up some comments for me today, and I showed up and we talked about it, and her comments were very extremely brief. She said I was probably better at ad-libbing a speech than having her write one. And I think she's probably correct. But then we went on and talked about her dog chewing up her house, and that's where we resorted to, let's take a look at maybe buying some chew toys and solve that problem. So the advice comes from dealing with the permanent fund and retirement accounts all the way down to chew toys, I guess, and areas. But I guess the point I'd like to make today in this kind of a relaxed conversation with the community is, you know, when we look today at customer satisfaction, entrepreneurship, and we expanded out beyond our customer base and beyond our immediate family into our communities, also our extended communities, if we go north to Wrangell or west to Prince of Wales, and for that matter all the way up through southeast. From a political aspect, and I should talk a little bit about that, from a political aspect, we're having some challenges, and that's to put it mildly, in coastal Alaska with the redistricting as far as just the growth of population in the rail belt versus southeast, which actually was stagnant, but outside of Juneau went backwards over that 10 years. So we've lost representation, and then there's been some members change throughout coastal Alaska. So it's put coastal Alaska and basically all rural Alaska in a difficult political position as far as just mustering the votes and to deal with, as mentioned in the press the last couple of days, for instance, a piece of legislation that may be beneficial to the larger communities dealing with some healthcare issues that will most likely be detrimental to all of our communities and actually cost the borough and city hall a substantial amount of funds in order to roll back to the taxpayer, property taxpayer mainly, because we can only push so much onto the sales tax visitors area. So as we try to move forward and deal with these things, I think one of the things we need to concentrate on is the cohesive unit of Southeast and working together with Wrangell, with Petersburg, even with Juneau, even though politically they're a little bit of an anomaly in Southeast, and then, you know, west to Sitka and smaller communities. Because if we don't stick together, we're not going to keep the momentum that we built up the last decade moving. And we see it in our population numbers as far as the momentum, the stabilized increase. We see it in our school numbers. And you see it in the attitude of the community members as you travel and walk around and talk to people about the condition of their town, condition of their school, just the attitude of the community in general. So that message I'm going to try to bring to the mayors is Southeast Conference and throughout Southeast as they come through my office this fall or this winter in the legislature. And let's try not to get, you know, too distracted amongst the, you know, the inner family squabbles in Southeast, and we concentrate on working together as a unit so we can move forward our energy expansion, deal with our marine highway, our transportation, deal with our schools. Because if we don't work together, what ends up happening is we get squabbling down here in Southeast, some of what my colleagues, I'm not even sure, recognize we're part of the state. And that's how far removed some of them are from Southeast. And they tease us about it. But I know in that teasing, there's some resemblance of truth within it. It'll put us in a better position to deal with our issues as we go forward. We have a need to continue the expansion of the shipyard, and we could see the benefits of the community there. We need to expand our hydro capacity. I was at a discussion with the chief of staff of the governor yesterday in Juneau about the need to expand the water storage in the lakes, not only here but virtually all of our lakes in Southeast and Kodiak have water capacity issues. They don't bank enough water. Swan is the next target to raise. Blue Lake and Sitka is already under construction. They're actually raising that dam 83 feet at a cost of about 140 or 150 million by the time they pay everybody. I don't want to say pay off, but you know, pay all the consultants and pay everybody under the sun. It's probably 80 or 90 million in construction, and the rest is the middleman. You know, but we, unfortunately, last year didn't get to participate. We in rural Alaska, including Western and Kodiak and the chain, didn't participate in the grand execution of the Rail Belt Energy solution, which is going to cost the Treasury somewhere around $500 million, give or take a few pennies. And the reason that was able to take place was because rural Alaska wasn't in a place to participate, and participate meaning basically block the movement of items or solutions like this without some help in rural Alaska. There was nobody there to actually do it. So at the end of the day, we're going to move forward with some energy solutions for the rail belt, which will continue to hold their energy costs down, and that's why Anchorage is the size of Anchorage is today. Their equivalent oil price and energy to heat their home is $1.50, roughly, $1.70, somewhere in there, with natural gas. And that's why the oil industry is based in Anchorage. It's cost of energy. We down here in Southeast struggle with heating our homes on oil and you know, generating hydro at roughly a 12-cent cost, 11, 12 cents, somewhere near to the consumer. And it varies from Juneau to Ketchikan, Wrangell, Petersburg, and Sitka. Sitka looks like it's going to hit 17, 18 cents. If they don't get more state help, they'll be probably pushing 20. They're in a disadvantage in Southeast relative to Wrangell, Petersburg, and Ketchikan. And I've expressed that to them. It's not the position that is beneficial to the community. Because we are actually moving forward fairly well in Southeast, southern side. Even though we, you know, grumble once in a while and have had issues, at the end of the day, we have the potential of having two new mines opened up on Prince of Wales. We have the potential of building ferries, which are going to hopefully get the execution orders in the spring to move forward with two replacement ships for the Marine Highway. There's a third one that has $40 million already funded. Was 50, but they peeled off 10 last year, the Tuscamena, to replace that. So those projects will be underway. I don't know the capacity of the shipyard, but I'm sure if they could build two build two Alaska class, they can certainly tackle the third one. And I'm confident of that, and I'm going to have some conversations with DOT about that. There's no reason why we can't do that. And if we have to accelerate, and I've asked the shipyard to give me a list of the finished concept in dollars that we need to put in place, and if we need to, in my opinion, the state, step up and get it built out, the sooner the better, and we can have those ships underway. It's been in the press numerous days or numerous months about the fiasco with the Tuscamena. Bad wells, bad workmanship, wrong-sized plates, you know, to sink tens of thousands of dollars, actually hundreds of thousands of dollars, into those old ships is not good business practice. And you wouldn't get the entrepreneurial award of the year if you made decisions like that. And I doubt very much if you'd get customer service award of the year, because the customers would probably want a newer boat with newer amenities. So we've got a little disconnect here to work on. But we're going to move forward and push for those areas, and we're going to continue to express our need for hydro expansion, energy expansion in Southeast. And I just want to make a couple other quick comments, because there's a couple things out there that I think it'd be nice for everybody to be aware of. We are, as we all know, right next door to BC. And Alberta has a vast quantity of oil they can't get out of Alberta. They've got oil reserves roughly the size of Saudi Arabia. They have no way they can ship itself by pipeline with their expansion they want to go. They want to go up to about 5 million barrels a day, which is 2.5 times their maximum capacity of taps in its heyday. And they're opening up vast gas reserves. And they're going to get it to the coast one way or the other. It's going east, going west, going south, or going to go north. But they're going to get the tidewater. They don't have any choice, and they're losing billions of years as they're hemmed in. Well, we have the opportunity then in Southeast to look forward to trying to bring in LNG, liquefied natural gas, and or compressed gas to run turbines or other energy generation items, also possibly some of our home heating. So that's in the works, and it's probably a few years out. There's firms that are meeting with communities. One target was Ketchikan, and another one is Dutch Harbor. The prize target for that scenario of shipping is actually Fairbanks, but there's some political issues there, because they could ship it to Fairbanks and truck it cheaper than we can build a little gas line down to Fairbanks and deliver it. But that's another subject for another day. But that is in the works. So not only are we going to be pushing for hydro expansion, we're going to be looking for access to natural gas for coastal Alaska. The other item I want to touch bases on a little bit, I don't want to get too far into the political stuff because it's, you know, we're here on talking about benefits of capitalism and how it makes a nicer community. And when you boil it down to individuals, we're going to have a couple that are going to get some awards. But we individually, and collectively, own one of the richest hydrocarbon bases on the planet, sitting in Prudhoe and Kuparuk, of which we're looking at getting our natural gas to Tidewater. And the big three, Exxon, BP, and Conoco, announced their targeted location is probably around Nikiski, Cook Inlet. And they're moving forward. I have thought for the last several years we've got a very good chance of having an LNG export line. Project is about $50 to $60 billion. And I think at the end of the day, we have the best chance ever to have that. You don't take your gas off when you open up the oil basin until such time as you depressurize your oil field, because you're going to lose billions of dollars in oil in the ground, and now it's time to go after our gas. Point Thompson is a gas field. Exxon is interested in our gas, not so much our oil. They're spending hundreds of millions opening up Point Thompson, and they want that gas to market. Otherwise, they're stuck up there. And one possibility is take it to Prudhoe and re-inject it, but they don't have a lot of options. So I think we're in a good position to have a gas line. Frank Murkowski, even though a lot of people in the state don't like to hear about it, Frank Murkowski was a lot more correct than he was incorrect on his concept of putting forward a gas line. And you're going to see, in my opinion, when we go forward with a gas project, it'll be similar to the Stranded Gas Act. In other words, the value of the gas at the wellhead, and think of it as when it comes out of the ground, natural gas, is substantially less than oil. And what you end up having with gas is you have a very high transportation cost. So by the time you take your it says I'm out of time. But I got 2 more minutes. I put it on 18 minutes. I think I started late. But by the time you pay your transportation down your pipeline through your processing and your liquefaction, it's extremely high cost relative to your wellhead value versus oil. So don't mix up the oil debate with the gas debate. They're two different income streams, two different hydrocarbon streams. Don't bring in the oil baggage into the gas. And hope, for your grandchildren's sake, that we, the state, have commensurate ownership in the pipeline, the liquefaction plant, and the processing facility. And the processing would be on the north end of it. And actually, the liquefaction plant is what it is. I always mispronounce it, but liquefaction plant. And we need to put in probably about $10 billion, preferably, in my opinion, in cash, which we have in several different piles. Actually, we can take it from two different pots. And we'd get a regulated rate of return, like a utility, of 12 to 14% on it, which would spin off about $1 billion a year. And that doesn't count the value of the gas coming out of the ground, and we'd get a piece of that, too. But that can be measured in hundreds of millions of dollars less than the other value. So as we go forward, just remember, Frank is going to have the last laugh on this one, because I think, in my opinion, after being around the post numerous years on this subject, he was a lot further along in the structure of the industry and how things work than the legislature or the staff within Department of Natural Resources or Revenue. And then part of Frank's problem was he was just too dang far ahead of everybody. And now people have caught up, and I think that's going to be recognized over the next couple of years. And I mentioned to him the other night, a couple weeks ago when I was here, saw him at the landing, and you can see the old governor's eyes just light up because he's a finance guy, he's a banker. He knows what's going to take to make it work. I just want to make sure that we don't get derailed and end up with just wellhead value for our gas. And that's why he wanted us to own 20% of the pipe. And I don't know if 20% is the right number. If it's 18, 22, 16, that can be haggled out later on. But clearly, it's in our children's interest because we're going to be taking oil and gas out of the Arctic for well over 100 years. So there's that much volume up there. So we are in the beginning of the hydrocarbon era, not approaching the end. And with that, I'd like to have the Rotary folks come up, Rotary presidents, and we're going to hand out a few awards. Just remember, without capitalism, these awards wouldn't be here, and our standard of living would be a heck of a lot lower. And we appreciate customer service and entrepreneurship.